must seriously limit the applicability of Scherner's theory. Arbitrariness in dream interpretation seems in no wise excluded, especially since a stimulus may be expressed by several representations in the content of the dream. Thus, Scherner's associate, Volkelt, has already found it impossible to confirm the representation of the body as a house. Another objection is that here again, dream activity is attributed to the mind as a useless and aimless activity, since according to the theory in question, the mind is content with forming fantasies about the stimulus with which it is concerned, without even remotely contemplating anything like a discharge of the stimulus. But Scherner's theory of the symbolization of bodily stimuli by the dream receives a heavy blow from another objection. These bodily stimuli are present at all times, and according to general assumption, the mind is more accessible to them during sleep than in waking. It is thus incomprehensible why the mind does not dream continually throughout the night, and why it does not dream every night, and about all the organs. If one attempts to avoid this objection by making the condition that a special stimuli must proceed from the eye, the ear, the teeth, the intestines, in order to arouse dream activity, one is confronted by the difficulty of proving that this increase of stimulation is objective, which is possible only in a small number of cases. If the dream of flying is a symbolization of the upward and downward motion of the pulmonary lobes, either this dream, as has already been remarked by Strumpel, would be dreamt much oftener, or an accentuation of the function of breathing during the dream would have to be demonstrable. Still another case is possible, the most probable of all, that now and then special motives directing attention to the visceral sensations which are universally present are active, but this case takes us beyond the range of Scherner's theory. The value of Scherner's and Volkelt's discussions lies in the fact that they call attention to a number of characteristics of the dream content which are in need of explanation, and which seem to promise new knowledge. It is quite true that symbolizations of organs of the body and of their functions are contained in dreams, that water in a dream often signifies a desire to urinate, that the male genital may often be represented by a staff standing erect, or by a pillar, etc. In dreams which show a very animated field of vision, and brilliant colours, in contrast to the dimness of other dreams, the interpretation may hardly be dismissed that they are dreams of visual stimulation, any more than it may be disputed that there is a contribution of illusory formations in dreams which contain noise and confusion of voices. A dream like that of Scherner, of two rows of fair, handsome boys standing opposite to each other on a bridge, attacking each other and then taking their places again, until finally the dreamer himself sits down on the bridge and pulls a long tooth out of his jaw, or a similar one of Volkelt's, in which two rows of drawers play a part, and which again ends in the extraction of a tooth, dream formations of this sort, which are related in great numbers by the authors, prevent our discarding Scherner's theory as an idle fabrication without seeking to find its kernel of truth. We are now confronted by the task of giving the supposed symbolization of the dental stimulus an explanation of a different kind. Throughout our consideration of the theory of the somatic sources of dreams, I have refrained from urging the argument which is inferred from our dream analyses. If we have succeeded in proving, by a procedure which other authors have not applied in their investigation of dreams, that the dream as a psychic action possesses value peculiar to itself, that a wish supplies the motive for its formation, and that the experiences of the previous day furnish the immediate material for its content, any other theory of dreams neglecting such an important method of investigation, and accordingly causing the dream to appear a useless and problematic psychic reaction to somatic stimuli, is dismissible without any particular comment. Otherwise there must be, which is highly improbable, two entirely different kinds of dreams, of which only one has come under our observation, while only the other has been observed by the earlier connoisseurs of the dream. It still remains to provide a place for the facts which are used to support the prevailing theory of somatic dream stimuli within our own theory of dreams. We have already taken the first step in this direction in setting up the thesis that the dream activity is under a compulsion to elaborate all the dream stimuli which are simultaneously present into a unified whole. We have seen that when two or more experiences capable of making an impression have been left over from the previous day, the wishes which result from them are united into one dream. Similarly, that an impression possessing psychic value and the indifferent experiences of the previous day are united in the dream material, provided there are available connecting ideas between the two. Thus the dream appears to be a reaction to everything which is simultaneously present as actual in the sleeping mind. As far as we have hitherto analyzed the dream material, we have discovered it to be a collection of psychic remnants and memory traces which we were obliged to credit, on account of the preference shown for recent and infantile material, with a character of actuality, though the nature of this was not at the time determinable. Now it will not be difficult to foretell what will happen when new material in the form of sensations is added to these actualities of memory. These stimuli likewise derive importance for the dream because they are actual. They are united with the other psychic actualities in order to make up the material for dream formation. To express it differently, the stimuli which appear during sleep are worked over into the fulfillment of a wish, the other component parts of which are the remnants of daily experience with which we are familiar. This union, however, is not inevitable. We have heard that more than one sort of attitude towards bodily stimuli is possible during sleep. Wherever this union has been brought about, it has simply been possible to find for the dream content that kind of presentation material which will give representation to both classes of dream sources, the somatic as well as the psychic. The essential nature of the dream is not changed by this addition of somatic material to the psychic sources of the dream. It remains the fulfillment of a wish, without reference to the way in which its expression is determined by the actual material. I shall gladly find room here for a number of peculiarities, which serve to put a different face on the significance of external stimuli for the dream. I imagine that a cooperation of individual, physiological, and accidental factors, conditioned by momentary circumstances, determines how one will act in each particular case of intensive, objective stimulation during sleep, the degree of the profoundness of sleep, whether habitual or accidental in connection with the intensity of the stimulus, will in one case make it possible to suppress the stimulus so that it will not disturb sleep. In another case they will force an awakening, or will support the attempt to overcome the stimulus by weaving it into the texture of the dream. In correspondence with the multiplicity of these combinations, external objective stimuli will receive expression more frequently in the case of one person than in that of another. In the case of myself,